Tough Guy seems to focus more on masculinity and male roles in the media. And for the benefit of the listeners who haven't seen the film, could you just briefly surmise the film?
Yeah, Tough Guys is really about the connection between normal masculinity and violence. The way in which we're raising boys to become men puts a high premium on intimidation, on power, on control, and on violence. And in that sense, we shouldn't be very surprised at the levels of violence that we see in society, in that they're connected to how we're raising boys to become men. I really sort of, this became clear to me when the film is with a person called Jackson Katz, who is nationally known as an educator around anti-violence stuff. And he called me in the spring of 1998 after one of the school shootings in the spring of 1998. And he said, wanted us to work on a film together, because he said, this is a teachable moment in the culture. And we are not having the kind of debate we need to have about this. Because he said, all the headlines in the newspapers and on television, etc., was about, you know, kids killing kids and, you know, what's wrong with the problem of youth violence, you know, why are our children acting this way? And he said to me on the phone, it was one of those key sort of defining moments for me, he said, this is not kids killing kids, this is boys killing boys and boys killing girls. And we said that, it was just actually absolutely so clear that, in fact, the question of violence, when you start looking at it closely, you know, 90% of violence, you know, whether it is murder, whether it is assault, whether it is sexual assault, whether it is robbery, whether it is, I mean, any kind of violence you want to look at, between 85 to 99% of that violence is committed by men. So when 90% of violence is committed by one gender, you've got to take a close look at how we are raising boys to become men, because that violence is connected to that upbringing. And so the film Tough Guys is about looking at the cultural context within which masculinity is connected to intimidation and to power and to violence, and how we're producing violent boys and violent men, not as extreme, not as something that is, you know, as an aberration, but as something that is absolutely normal. And so we shouldn't be surprised at the levels of violence we have and the levels of male violence we have, given the cultural environment that encourages that.
Would you say masculinity is a social construct?
Yes, masculinity is a cultural and social construct. I mean, many people have talked about masculinity and femininity, you know, as performances, that we perform what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. Now, that's not to say there's no differences between men and women. You know, as we pop out of the womb, you know, physically we look very different. We have different body parts. But, you know, most of the evidence shows that whatever difference there is between men and women is in fact constructed by the society and is not given by nature, is not given by biology. And most of the recent work on this has used the concept of performance, that what we're doing is performing a role, and we learn that role from the culture around us. So we learn how to be men, we learn how to be women from the dominant messages that are there in the mass media. And my work has sort of looked at that, as we looked at both how girls are encouraged to take on a particular notion of femininity, and now with Tough Guys, how boys are encouraged and are really channeled into very, very narrow ways of thinking about how they can be human beings in this culture.
The Tough Guys itself, you mentioned last night that it was a performance, a way for boys and men to perform masculinity through power and violence, and you argued that masculinity, like this, is not natural. And there are those who would say that violence is a natural part of maleness, that you and I, for instance, as men, are genetically inclined toward violence and assault and rape and all that. How would you respond to those people who take a pseudo or a scientific approach and claim that it is genetically encoded in us?
I don't think there's actually very much scientific about it. I think most of it is sort of based on common sense assumptions of male violence. I mean, the first thing I would say is, you know, if violence is so connected to male biology, then why are the majority of men, in fact, non-violent? when, again, when we talk about violence being, you know, so much violence being committed by men, we have to remember at the same time, I mean, it's the, you know, is the glass half full, is the glass half empty? There's a lot of violence, but in fact, the vast majority of men are non-violent. If it was encoded in our genes, why should that be the case? I mean, there may well be, you know, there may well be, again, I don't want to say there's no physical differences, that it's, you know, absolutely everything is cultural. I think that will be an extreme, yeah, and a wrong position to take. For a lot of the scientific, a lot of this new debates about, you know, whether violence is encoded in male genes, actually, essentially comes down to a discussion of one thing, which is testosterone. And the evidence seems to show that boys have more testosterone in their bodies than girls do. And then the assumption is made that this is what then leads to aggressiveness, this is what leads to violence. But one of the things we know now from our research is that biological predispositions only ever work themselves out in cultural and social contexts. They never work themselves out in isolation. They always are shaped within a very, very particular context. You know, and there's not much you can do about biology, but there's a lot you can do about culture, and there's a lot you can do about society. So even if you think there is some biological basis to this, and I think that's a very, very small amount, but even if you think that, you still have to pay attention to the particular context within that's played out. So even if you believe in biology, you still should be an activist around the issue of the images that we see, around the issue of what is considered to be normal masculinity. That is, what is there in the culture that exacerbates that tendency, if there is such a tendency? But again, I don't think there is. You know, I think the discussion around biology is meant to deflect us away from doing anything in this, in the present world. It's a way to say, look, there's not much you can do. Men are beasts. Men are just violent from the start. All you can do is try and, you know, control them. And I think that's a very, very dangerous... I mean, it's a very conservative reactionary view that says you can't change the world. The world is always changed. The world can always be changed. And one of the things I always want to insist with people I speak to and with my students when I teach is, look, the world has been made by someone and it can be changed by someone. And if you don't change it, then someone else will. So, but in that sense, it's a very conservative view that says the world can't be changed. It can be changed. At the same time, this is a very dangerous theory for boys and for men, because if it's in the genes, if it's in the biology, and you can't do anything about it, then the only thing you can do is control men. The only thing you can do is drug them, which is what we've tended to do. I mean, you know, the amount of Ritalin that is prescribed to young boys, yeah, it's just out of sight in this society. I mean, it's trying to find, you know, a biological chemical solution to a social problem, and we are always destined to fail when that happens. You can drug people, you can lock them up, you know, you can execute them, and that's essentially the tact that we've chosen in society. And I think that's the biological argument is a very, very dangerous argument for boys. It's often presented in a way that says this is an argument that's pro-male, because it shows that men can't help themselves. That, yeah. But it's not. It's actually a very, very anti-male argument, because the implications of that argument are nothing but negative for most men.
Speaking of things not being quite as they seem, Howard Stern, for instance, gets a lot of credit for being a rebel and an anti-establishment figure. You see him in a different way.
Yeah, the idea that Howard Stern is sort of, you know, cutting edge and cool and anti-establishment figure is just, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, PR on the part of Howard Stern. I mean, he sort of presents himself as, you know, against the mainstream, but when you look at his messages around gender especially, I mean, what he's reflecting there is straightforward sexism. And in fact, you know, it's very significant that most of Howard Stern's audience, you know, is young, white males. And I think we should always look to see if someone is popular, who are they popular with? And there may be a few women who like him, but the vast majority of his audience is young, white males. And so we have to ask, what's Howard Stern doing that's getting young, white men to listen to him in such large numbers? And what Howard Stern does is he presents a world. I mean, Stern, if you wanted an image of Stern, I mean, Stern is someone who represents a culture that is scared stiff of new gender relations, that's scared stiff of the revolution that feminism has made possible, that's scared stiff of strong women and independent women, and is scared stiff of actually having relationships that are interdependent and that are based on equality. And what Howard Stern says is, look, in the last 20 years, the gender world may be changing all around you, but you listen to the Howard Stern show, and it's like going back to the 1950s. The gender world on the Howard Stern show is a very, very stereotypical, old-fashioned, traditional world in which women know their place, they're there for sex, they're there to be degraded, and they're there to be looked at. And the sad thing is that gets an audience in this time. But again, if you wanted to really, if you really want to find out what Howard Stern was really about, just look at the comments that he made after the Columbine shootings. It's one of the great censored stories of last year, actually, that Howard Stern's comments didn't get wider distribution and there wasn't discussion about them. Because, what he said, as soon as the Columbine stuff happened when he was on the air, instead of identifying with the girls and boys running out of the school, who Stern identified with was the shooters, was with Harris and Klebold. And he said, he said these guys are real losers because, before killing these girls and before killing these boys, they didn't rape them. If he'd been them, then he would have raped the girls before he would have killed them. That tells you something about the mentality that Howard Stern is coming from. To think of Howard Stern as an anti-authority rebel, what a rebel. What does he do with the Columbine incident? He makes a rape joke. To the extent that people buy into this notion of him as a radical, they bought into the public relations that he's spinning. You should listen closely to what he's saying rather than how he positions himself.
Going back over the last 20 years, you mentioned there's been a drastic change in gender roles. As far as images of men and women go on television, men have gotten much larger. We saw this in the excerpts from your film last night. The wrestlers of 20 or 30 years ago were much smaller, less toned than the behemoths of today. Women, full-figured women, were much more popular in the past, and now they're what we call heroin chic, very, very tiny women. Why are these images out there? What brought about the change? What makes them so popular? And how are they connected to power and masculinity?
I mean, it's really always interesting to look at how patterns operate in pop culture and historical patterns. And again, when you look at images of men, they've just become... In the film, the section we put it in, we've titled Upping the Ante. And the examples we use are, if you look at Batman from the 1960s and Adam West as Batman to, the modern incarnations of Batman in the movies, the modern Batman is much muscular, is more rugged, is much harder. If you look at Superman, again from the 50s to Christopher Reeve, the image is totally different. If you look at wrestling, it's absolutely, when you look back, Jesse Ventura, and to the time when he was popular, he's called Jesse the Body Ventura, but in fact his body would be nothing these days. His body would be absolutely normal, or actually less than normal in what passes for wrestling these days. So something is going wrong. Something is up. Something is happening in culture in which the stakes in masculinity have really been raised. At the same time, images of women have gone the opposite way. They've gone from being, full-figured women that had some presence in the world, that took up space, to being, the waifs of today. Whether it's Calista Flockhart or Jennifer Love Hewitt is a good example. I mean, she's very thin except for breasts. And so you have this sort of unnatural body for women nowadays, where they're very, very thin except for having very large breasts, which come from breast implants with almost everyone. Britney Spears is another example of that kind of body makeup. Now the question is why? Why have we seen these two twin sort of movements? Why have men gotten bigger and women have taken up less physical space. One place to look at the answer is to say, well, what's going on in the rest of society? What else is going on that? And remember, these images are produced by people who are in power, so they're largely about what's going on in the minds, in the anxieties, in the dreams of people who make Hollywood films, who make advertising, who are in charge of our media culture, because they're the ones who are really deciding this. And so I think if you looked at this, you'd say that white male power is under threat. And it's under threat, I think, it's come under threat in the last 30 years from feminism. And again, I know feminism is often derided as some small, obscure movement made up of women who hate men and who are ugly and hate sex. It's nothing of the sort. That's just the propaganda campaign against feminism. Feminism has been, you could argue, and I would argue, it's been one of the most powerful social movements in history. In the last 30 years, it has given us a new way to think about men, has given us a new way to think about women, and about the relations between men and women. And that revolution has been pretty deep. And men and women have lived lives in the last 30 years that would just not have been possible before. Now, if you're in power in the society, and that power rests on a particular notion of white heterosexual sexuality and a male power, then this is very threatening to you. So how do you respond? Well, you respond, in the culture, you respond through the images. You respond by making women weaker than they actually are. You respond by women taking up less physical space so they don't have as much presence in the world. You have Kate Moss becomes the ideal of the modern woman for someone who is highly threatened by the women's movement. In the same way, as the differences between men and women, the physical differences between men and women have become less important, for example, to how the economy functions. There are very few jobs in the modern world, especially as you go to a high-tech, information-based world, that are based upon physical prowess, in which men are much better at doing something than women. So physical differences have become much, much less pronounced in terms of what the economy requires. So how have men responded to that? How has the culture responded? Well, they responded then by... But men in general still tend to be bigger than women. Physically, they still tend to have a greater physical stature. And so the culture has responded by exacerbating that difference even more and taking the one place in the culture where there is still a difference and where men perhaps still have some advantage, and exacerbating that so that we now get these extreme examples of male bodies. And wrestling is a very good place to look. I mean, if you look at the size of the wrestlers compared to where the wrestlers were even 20 years ago, you see a dramatic difference. So something is going on. I mean, and the question is, and the only way to really understand what's going on is to look at the broader context. It's to look at what's going on in the minds of the people who are creating these things. And I said, if you looked at it from that perspective, what we're really seeing are their anxieties and their nightmares playing out. One way of looking at popular culture is to think about it as the dream life of the society. That is where the anxieties, that is where the neuroses are being worked out of the people who are in charge. And if you looked at that, if you looked at these images from that perspective, it would give you a pretty insightful way to thinking about how threatened the people are who make these images. So you've always got to put them in context. You've got to always be able to understand them within a broader environment that looks at their relationship to a bunch of other things.
There's a disturbing feedback mechanism in the larger images of men in the media. And that is men who are not quite so large and muscular, trying to compensate for their size in other ways, particularly with guns and violence. How do women who are not so small compensate for their lack of resemblance to the popular image? And how exactly does it play out both for men and women?
Well, for women... it works, it plays out largely internal to the body. And so, again, if you see these images of very, very thin women, just open up the pages of Vogue and of Glamour and of Yeah, any fashion magazine. Look at MTV, look at the advertising on MTV, look at the videos on MTV, look at movie stars. You know, they are all much, much thinner than the average woman. And so when if you're an average person looking at this, I mean, what it's designed to make you feel bad about yourself. That's the first function. It's designed to keep you on edge. It's designed to keep you always unhappy with your physical makeup. The other thing, and always thinking about your weight. And so it's not surprising, you know, that when women are asked about, you know, what is their number one wish, the thing that always comes out on top is to lose weight. I mean, when you think about it, you know, the number one wish of women is to lose weight. You know, it's not for higher wages. It's not for more respect. It's not for a whole bunch of other things that it could be. It's to look differently. When that becomes the number one wish of women, that tells you that these images have worked very deep into the psyches of girls and women. And so the effect on women is to make them feel bad about themselves. It's to turn their body into a war zone. It's to turn their own body as something that is against them. And so they are constantly at war with their own bodies. And how do you deal with that? You deal with that through compulsive dieting. You deal with that through compulsive exercising. You deal with that through surgery. It's really one of the great sort of tragedies of the contemporary age is the way in which our popular culture is designed to make one half of the population, the female half, feel absolutely terrible about itself, and to essentially keep them on edge all the time. For boys, it works out. For boys, it's a little bit different. Now, you know, if you're not big and tough and strong, the ideal image of masculinity is, you know, big, tough, strong, muscular. Although it's not only that, it's that, but it's also it's partly that. It's also a real man is in control. A real man, you know, doesn't let himself be intimidated. A real man, you know, looks after himself. So if you've bought into this whole complex, this whole construction of masculinity as being tied up with being big and tough and being intimidating and being powerful, but you're not big and tough, well, there is still a way that you can still enact masculinity. You may not have muscle, but you can get muscle, and you can get muscle through guns. All the shooters in the school shootings and what they said, you know, all of them said that they were being bullied by a dominant, largely jock culture. That is, they were being bullied by the mainstream image of what it means to be masculine. And they couldn't just reject it. They couldn't just say, well, I'd reject that, because that's an image they bought into. So once you bought into it and you're being victimized by it, well, how do you respond? Well, guns allowed them a way to become men. Guns, in fact, allowed them a way to exert control, to intimidate other people. In that sense, you know, I don't think there should be anything surprising about that. And again, we should look at gun violence as a masculinity issue. Again, why is the vast majority of gun violence committed by men? You know, the NRA is fond of saying, you know, it's not guns that kill people, it's people that kill people. Well, that's not true. It's men who do the vast majority of shooting. And again, the question is, you know, what's the different relationship of men in this culture that, in fact, guns become a way in which they can enact their manhood? If you look at it that way, I mean, if you think about, you know, gun violence as a masculinity issue, it changes totally the way you think about these things. Let me give you the most concrete example that we use in the film. Luke Woodham, who's one of the shooters, I think, from the Springfield, Oregon shooter. You know, when he was interviewed after, you know, when they asked him why he did this, he said, you know, killing people isn't weak killing people is gutsy and daring, and that's why he did it, because that was the way he could prove himself to be a man. So again, I think we've got to look to see, these are not just images, these are not, I mean, I think there's a way sometimes people say, oh, they're just popular culture images, they don't have any effect, you know, they're just there, they're not there, the images that we see are reflective of something, they're reflective of how we think about ourselves, and they're reflective of how other people think about ourselves. And we always then have to understand other issues in connection with that. And I think gun violence is a very, very good thing to understand. It's a very, very good way to rethink masculinity. Or rather, I put it the other way around. Masculinity is a very, very good way to rethink the issue of gun violence. Then, you know, again, a lot of talk about how guns are the great equalizer. You know, you don't have to be big and strong and tough to be able to control. You know, if that's the case, you know, why don't more women use guns? I mean, women are much smaller than men in general. So if it was only about guns being the great equalizer, you'd expect women, in fact, who have a disproportionate disadvantage when it comes to physical makeup, you'd think that they would be using guns in greater numbers. But in fact, they don't. And most of the time, the women use guns. They use them defensively. That is, they use them to stop themselves, you know, to stop attacks on them. I mean, that should tell us that it's what's being equalized is not just, you know, differences in physical bodies, that's one thing, but the cultural context where the differences mean something. And for boys, it means something differently than it does for girls.
I guess one question that really comes to my mind is, why are we only getting this information at the college level? Your films strike me as something that could easily be shown to middle school students or perhaps even younger. And probably are a much-needed supplement to the education at that level. Have you considered going in and trying to get exposure at that age? If so, how has it gone? Have you had trouble competing with the corporate images such as Channel One and so forth?
That's a very good question. And I would love to be able to get these, you know, to get this kind of discussion going. And our films are really a way to get discussion going about these issues. And that's one of the ways in which power works. Power works by never being discussed, by these issues never being discussed. And one of the things that our films do from the Media Education Foundation is they provide a forum whereby these discussions can take place. And that's the most important thing. And so, for example, the feedback we've had from Tough Guys has been, you know, really, really positive, both at the college level, but it's also been, we've also started distributing it a little bit at high schools. And the feedback has just been, you know, tremendous. That this, the Tough Guys, is a way for boys to start talking about this, about these issues, but in a way that doesn't make them feel intimidated, that doesn't make them feel threatened. This is not an attack on them as boys. So I would love to do this. But, you know, we have limited funds. We have, you know, we have to go to where our market is, and our market right now is at universities and a little bit at high schools. And the Media Education Foundation, you know, we function as a business, even though we're a non-profit. We've never gotten any grants. And we would love to get grants that allow us to do education at younger and younger levels. So I think that's where it's really needed. In one sense, you know, by the time you get to college, it's too late. I mean, you know, you're really set. And, you know, you can start questioning things a little bit. But if we really want to affect the future of this country, the future of this society, then we really got to put on the agenda education as a whole. Because, you know, the reason we're producing violent boys and violent men and insecure girls is as a result of the culture and a result of the education system. And if we want to have healthier girls and healthier boys, more productive boys and girls, then we've got to really seriously think about, you know, what is it about our education system that is producing a different kind of individual, and start to battle at that level. Especially as you said in your question, especially as corporations have targeted high schools and targeted middle schools, have targeted elementary schools. That is, if parents don't do it, then corporations will. And corporations are the most anti-democratic force in society. I mean, their goal is one goal, and that is profits for themselves. I think if you look at the relationship, if you think of how corporations think about children, I think that'll become very clear. You know, for example, you know, why is there advertising on children's television? You know, when you look at Saturday morning television, Saturday morning cartoons, when you look at television that's, you know, a television that's directed at, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-olds, you know, why is there advertising directed for those people? Well, on those programs, do 4, 5, 6-year-olds have huge amounts of money that they're going to spend? No. You know, they have some, you know, small amounts of pocket money. But what the function of advertising on those programs is to turn kids into lobbyists for products against their parents. It's a form of child abuse. That is, I mean, and it's really insane when you think about it, that parents, by letting their kids watch television and watching kids' television, what they're essentially doing is allowing this child molester into the house who's going to convince their child that they need the latest gadget or the latest game. And the job then of that child is to pester their parents until they get what they need. It's an insane way to think about child rearing, in which corporations have turned children against their parents. But that's how corporations think of children. Corporations don't think of children as citizens. They don't think about them as human beings. They think about them as a market. And to the extent that, you know, corporations are now starting to take over more and more of school, of elementary school, of middle school, of high school, and essentially we are turning over our kids as slaves to corporations. The question is, you know, do citizens of in the United States have a different vision of what education should be about? That education, in fact, should be about training citizens and, you know, and creating healthy, productive, diverse individuals. We really have to start battling over that, because at the moment we have given up the fight to corporations. As I said, and the image that I use is, you know, it's like letting a child molester loose on your child. I don't know why anyone would do it. So the more discussion we have around this, the better.
For those listeners who are out there who want to learn more about this, who want to find a way to get a hold of your films, your documentaries, where can they go? I know you have a website. What's the address of that, and what are some other avenues?
Yeah, I would there's a lot of places you can go, especially on the web these days. I mean, the web is not the solution to everything, but it has allowed a greater range of people to be able to distribute stuff and to be able to get access to it, if you know what you're looking for. So I would just say, I mean, the media education website is www.mediaed.org, mediaed.org. You could go to my website as well. I have a website, which is www.sutjahlly.com. That's SUTJHALLY.com. And on that website, actually, I have a number of articles that you can download that deal with some of these issues, that deal with masculinity issues. I've got three articles that I wrote with Jackson Katz that are on there that can be downloaded. But people can also look to other places as well. There is lots of activity on the web. There is a place called the Media Channel where people can get alternative views. There's a place called indiemedia.com, in which, again, you know, there is, in which acts as a sort of clearinghouse or a centralized place where there is lots of independent reporting that goes on. There is an organization called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting that has a website. I mean, it's not a matter of them not being, just, but people have to be motivated to look for them. You know, there. I read magazines like The Nation, like The Progressive, like Mother Jones, and again, not as though any one of them is going to give me the answer. But I think, you know, the role of citizens in a democratic society should be to expose themselves to as much information as possible, so that they can make decisions, democratic decisions, based on, you know, based on really knowing what's going on, rather than on misinformation. And at the moment, there is no excuse for not knowing. I mean, the mainstream media will not tell you that. I mean, you can't get any of this by reading, you know, by watching NBC or ABC or CBS or any of them, or CNN or any of the major networks. They are so closely controlled by corporations that you'll never hear really radical and really diverse viewpoints. You've really got to go outside of that. And if you do, then there's a lot of places out there. And I'm actually really hopeful right now about the possibility of activism in the country, because I think young people especially are dying for new ways to understand this material. I mean, these are people who've lived within the consumer culture all their lives, and they see its emptiness. They know that it doesn't go anywhere. They know that it is in fact deeply anti-humane, that it's not actually catering to real human needs. And so I think the demonstrations in Seattle, the demonstrations in Washington, the outburst of independent media, the movements around the sweatshops at universities that have taken place, I see all these as very, very good indications that there are going to be a lot of challenges to the present order in the next 10 to 20 years. So I'm actually very hopeful. But it does require people to be active, does require people to be looking for this kind of information.
I understand in your next work you're going to be taking a look at the world of professional wrestling, which you seem to have a little bit of a fascination with. And I guess we'll end the interview on that. What is your fascination with wrestling? And how is the next film going to explore it?
Yeah, the reason we should look at wrestling, one reason we should look at wrestling is that it's just incredibly popular. And anytime something is that popular means it's worth paying attention to. So that's one reason to look at wrestling. The other reason to look at it is, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's going on there. I mean, for those people who haven't seen wrestling, you know, for a while, this is not the wrestling of Jesse Ventura. Although, you know, one reason to look at wrestling is Jesse Ventura, which is, you know, here is now, you know, an ex-professional wrestler who is now a governor of a state. I mean, that tells you where models will come from for the future, where we will draw inspiration. You know, when you can have a governor, but, you know, come out of this realm. That tells you that, you know, this is a significant place. And wrestling, I mean, wrestling, the wrestling video, and which I'm going to do with Jackson Katz again, who I did Tough Guys with, it's a follow-up, essentially, to Tough Guys. It's a follow-up to look at issues, you know, what's going on with gender in wrestling. What's going on, I mean, again, in wrestling, you know, every problem is solved by violence. There is no problem that is not solved by violence in wrestling. And so we have to look at sort of overall messages, cultural messages that are being given, that are being sent out through wrestling. It's also, you know, I mean, on the one hand, that's what you have to look at in terms of, you know, looking at it from a cool, detached perspective, analytical perspective. At the same time, you have to understand why it's so popular. And in one sense, you know, I'm sort of fascinated by it because I'm, in one sense, a fan of it. You know, because I actually watch it and it drags me in. Because the writing is so brilliant, you know, they've now got writers who used to write for MTV and for the Conan O'Brien show. Again, I presume everyone knows that, you know, everything is totally choreographed. All the storylines are absolutely fixed. Yeah, and they've got some very, very talented writers who are developing storylines, who are developing characters, who are developing dialogue. And there is, you know, so it's just, on the one hand, it's just very, 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 very smart television. I actually think the best and most creative television there is. At the same time, the violence, even though you know it's choreographed, is so good. I mean, the athleticism of the wrestlers is so good that even when you know it's choreographed and they are, you know, you still are amazed by how, you know, people are not hurt. So for all kinds of reasons, you know, for its popularity, it, you know, how good it is at the writing, you should study wrestling. I wrote an article with Jackson Katz a while ago on wrestling, which is actually on my website. And we ended it, the way we ended it was to say, you know, a lot of people think that wrestling, you shouldn't look at wrestling because it's just, you know, entertainment and just innocent. And we said, you know, to those people, we just have two words, Jesse Ventura. Well.